Hello. It's good to talk to you. We need to start with some housekeeping. I begin by expressing my sorrow and disappointment at my own schedule of editing. You should now, everybody, have received edits on all your writing up till yesterday. That is the first essay drafts and journal entries, and all of that should have been current 2 weeks ago. But the epidemic is an odd place, as you all know, and time is remarkably fractured, and things we think are going to be done immediately take forever, and things that we never needed to do before we have to do all the time. And so I find myself, after a third of a century of teaching, well, actually 35 years of teaching, just as bewildered by how this all works as I could possibly be. I spent 7.5 years developing a way to deliver law school courses without actually being able to rely upon us all being in a law school together, and after a half semester of dealing with it last spring and more than half of a term this fall, I still understand that although I thought a lot of things through, I didn't have any way to think through the mental disruptions of life in a prolonged disaster. But at any rate, we are up to date, and that means that it's now time for a first draft of a second essay. The link for a template is on the front page, and I hope to begin editing this coming weekend, so I would be grateful if you could put first drafts up by the end of Friday. And if you can't, well, by Monday that would be really good. You need to think about how to revise the first essay for a second draft in light of whatever it is that I hopefully had to suggest by way of useful routes to improvement. The mechanism for revision is simple. Just put a whole new draft down on top of the old one, erasing the old one completely, because indeed, of course, there's nothing completely erased. We live in a world in which nothing ever goes away, in the broader sense in which the course needs to think about technology, but we also live in a world of what programmers know as versioned file systems. That is to say, file systems which keep not just the current version of a file, but all previous versions of a file. Versioned file systems are just the ordinary form of thinking about how to store data for programmers, because every version of a program being worked on by different people has important information in every single version. Bugs that were introduced later and bugs that were fixed earlier and things that have been tried and should be kept even though they're not going to enter the main line of the project code. And so programmers have come over the last 15 years altogether through free software forms of versioning, which now dominate the world. Free software programmers have made extraordinary achievements in productive sharing and collaborating of massive numbers of people on extremely complicated works using what are at bottom versioned file systems that don't even require that all versions be taken from the same central place. They are distributed version control systems in which everybody can have as many versions of everything as they care to, branching and re-merging and doing everything they want with all versions of all pieces of immense code bases on which thousands of people are working together, and everything just keeps track of itself perfectly. We in the wiki have a simpler problem, but still one which is essentially versioned. And so every page in the wiki that we have exists in all the versions it has ever had. And you can see that easily enough by clicking the history button on the top right-hand corner of the page near the edit button. And you can look at all the different versions of every page. So when you make a new version of a draft, of course, the sensible thing to do is to let the version control system take care of it. Just wipe out everything that's there and put another version down on top. My comments go away, and your notes on my comments go away, and everything you thought about it before goes away, because it doesn't go away, because it's all still there. I look at the wiki not the way you do through the web interface only, but as a version-controlled file system, and I use all kinds of tools to track the different changes that go from one version to another of every page, and to find everything that any particular person has added on any particular page, whether it is at the top or the bottom of the stack of the versions. And so I can see the way in which the wiki as a whole evolves through a variety of different tools. And the easiest way, not the hardest way, but the easiest way for me to understand what has happened to one essay, namely yours, is for all the versions to exist complete and separate. And then I can look at the changes from one to the other. I can look at what it was that you did to your essay as you went through the drafts that brought you to draft official one. And I can look at what I said, and I can look at what you did, and I can see all of the other things that have happened to the page, if anybody else has commented or taken any trouble to make any suggestions. All of that can be analyzed most simply if you just scrape off what is there and put something new down when you make a new version. It will work perfectly. Thank you very much. So by the end of the weekend, we should have a first version of your first essay commented upon by me and a revision being planned. And then I will return comments. I should definitely hope much more swiftly than I did to the first essay on the first draft of your second essay. And then, to complete the work of the course, you will have to make one revision of each essay so that it has gone through at least two drafts. You are, of course, welcome, as you know from the evaluation policy, to continue working after the second draft. I will comment on your revisions, and you can revise further, and I don't care whether the course is officially over or not, because even before time was smashed by the hammer of the epidemic, semesters had ceased to make any sense as a unit of learning. If you are here for a year taking an LLM, the unit is the year. Of course it's the year. It's everything you did while you were with us, even if in this case you weren't with us at all. And if you're a law student taking a JD, then the unit is 3 years long of everything you did and everything you learned and everything that it taught you and everything you became, because it is becoming, which is the point of any professional graduate school, becoming a doctor, becoming a lawyer, becoming the particular doctor or lawyer or nurse or forest manager that you are. Because what we do when we make a professional school is to make a process which enables people in parallel to take journeys that are each somewhat the same and somewhat totally different to become the kinds of professionals in society that they want to be. And the idea that there are six terms in it, or two terms in it, or three and a half plus two abroad plus, is all ridiculous. It emerged from a world in which the information flow of teaching was on pieces of paper that got shuffled and returned and lost. And the idea of the continuing relevance of everything you read and write to everything you learn, which is apparent on the face of things, had to be qualified by the idea that education is cut up into terms, into spaces of time. That makes no sense in a world in which we keep everything in every version, online, all the time, available from everywhere, and whenever there is something we can do to assist ourselves or others to learn, all we need to do is pull it up and learn. We do learn by writing, as we learn by reading, as we learn by listening, as we learn by talking. The learning is also, after all, across multiple pathways, down multiple roads that take whatever lengths of time they take. I learn about the things I teach every year when I reread them, and then I learn more when I read what students have to say about them, and I learn still more when I think thereafter about the conversations that over the years, one on top another, I have had. And this, of course, is true for you as well. So every version of every piece of writing is an act of learning, and you should have as much support in that learning as you need. That's what it means to have a school. So, for the purpose of complying with the rules of the occupation, which involve grading and the announcement that you have done or not done, or done sufficiently or done superbly, or whatever crap it is that the occupation demands of us, we say that this course ends when you have done two essays in two drafts, and I have graded that work, which at least we can say there's some sense of structure about. I think about every draft of every piece of work, and I ask myself how much effort, how much commitment, and how much improvement, and from that, by some simple process of arithmetic, I can discover how much the thing is worth. When worth is established by the foolish factorial structure called the grade. But really what is happening is, at least I hope, that we are learning together. That I have things to teach and you have things to learn and you have things to teach me and I am trying my best to learn them. And in that process, there is a cycle of exchange. You write, I comment, you write, I think about it, I write again. We try and make it better by making it new all the time, by thinking it through again, by trying another way to express it, by looking for a way to make the essay teach what it has to say better to its readers, which is, after all, the work that you're engaged in, teaching and learning both. And I don't care when it stops. For the rest of your life, or at least for the rest of mine, since I'm the one who is in all likelihood going to go first, you could keep changing that essay and I would keep thinking about it with you. But the work of the course, the arbitrarily determined structure of now it exists and then it's over, requires you, by the time the grades are due at the beginning of next term, to have made one revision at least of two essays, each of which you wrote on a question you decided was important, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a pretty good basis upon which to boil everything down and cram it into little boxes and say it got a grade. And I regret having made that process just a little harder by taking a little bit too long, but every day is new and we can try and do it better. And if the epidemic were to go on longer still, I'm sure that it would be possible to refine the way we teach and learn in it. That's what I think needs to be said about housekeeping, except to say that next week we will also have, once I know that I'm not distracting you from the task of writing, the second technical exercise, a proxying browsing exercise, which will give you a way both to reduce the amount of identity you leak onto the net while you are using the browser to screw yourself, and also a way to provide better information security flow in and out of your computer or your surveillance device so that you are not giving away anything to the local untrusted wireless or data proprietary cellular network on which you are traveling. That project provides more bang for the buck than anything except the knowledge of how to get GPG keys made and private email that is really secure against really mediocre attackers up and running, as you did in exercise number one. We will continue those technical exercises, both in this course and in the follow-on course, until, if you have borne the burden of working with me for two terms, at the end of the year you will have some tradecraft that is not contemptible, and you will be able to navigate the world of the net in a better degree of safety and security and with more control over the display of your identity than pretty much anybody else who isn't a pro has. Now, we're back because we can't really think about what it means to exist safely and with power on the net without thinking about the management of identity, without thinking about the degree to which we are constantly engaged in giving ourselves away. We are back to the central question at the center of the composition of privacy, which is, why is anonymity important? The answer is at one and the same time mysterious and self-evident. Part of the difficulty, as I was saying last week in teaching this subject, is to manage to travel without undue impoliteness or apparent arrogance or vehemence between the state of understanding in which the idea of a world without anonymity makes you puke, and the general belief everywhere else outside that circle of dyspeptic or nauseated individuals, the general belief very successfully propounded over the years since Stuart Baker and I faced one another across the table of the Harvard Faculty Club in 1995, the idea which has been so successfully created and sold by governments and telecoms and platform companies all around the world, that anonymity is basically just a terrible thing needed by terrorists and criminals. The most important aspect of this, in my long but increasingly disillusioned experience of the subject, the most important element in this is that when we speak of anonymity, people immediately think about the anonymity of writing. The anonymity is disorder, chaos, and destruction message is fundamentally dependent upon the idea that what we use anonymity for is to write things which we want to disclaim or to be able to deny that we wrote. An activity which is, of course, possible for dissidents, but also possible for criminals and tax evaders and, you know, and therefore seems easily to set up some kind of balancing. Yes, well, it's good for people to have anonymity when they want to write bad things about North Korea, but it's not okay for people to do these horrible things, crime, terrorism, tax evasion, right? And we have to balance the, and all of that depends upon essentially taking the tiniest little piece at the tip of the iceberg and turning it into everything and then balancing that everything off against something else. Just intellectually a vacuous proposition. Because we do not begin with the crucial importance of the anonymity of reading. If you think for a moment about what it is that is Facebook's leverage, the power power that it exercises in relation to the users it consumes, you begin not with the fact that Facebook knows everything you write. That is indeed mostly trivial. You write crap that's meant to be read by a few people about things that don't really matter very much. The power of the platform is that it knows everything you read. It's evident in many different contexts, but of course, in the terrarium of surveillance, the Dzerzhinsky Square of everybody's life that is the presently existing social network kind of thing, it's painfully obvious that the real power lies in the fact that they have the logs of everything you read, every time you touch a thing, every time you load a page on the web with a Facebook like button on it, which is God knows way too many pages, every time you do a thing that involves interacting with some object in the web that they either control or are partnered with, your reading is observed. How long you spent, what you touched on the page, what you hovered over, all sorts of fundamental facts, not about what you said, but about what you read and therefore what you thought, are captured in the logs. The web as a federated system ordinarily means that the logs of all the accesses that you make to things are contained within the logs of those particular servers. I could, of course, like Canvas, use my curricular delivery system to spy on your reading. I could be using the logs of the wiki to analyze every single thing you read and how long you spend reading it and how you timed your submissions of your drafts and every single thing that you touched along the way. And I could conceivably be purchasing a bunch of information about your other click trails to try to understand and surveil in real time the relationship between my curriculum and everything else you did on the net, but I wouldn't. If everything you did were divided among 100 million servers and at least 50 million of those servers were operated by people who didn't want the logs to be spying on you and who ditched them or mothballed them or whatever else it was it took to keep other people from getting hold of them, well, then you would have the anonymity of reading, but you don't. So to begin with, then, we need to understand, as I tried to present in the Freedom of Thought and Media That Don't Spy on You talk of 2012 in Berlin, we need to think about the process of freedom of thought in relation to the anonymity of reading. As I said in an essay published in The Guardian once upon a time, what if every book had been reporting every single reader at headquarters for the last 500 years? How much democracy or liberty of thought or civil liberty of any kind would have come to exist in a world in which every book told power every single time that it was read? And we're not just talking about knowing what you read, we're talking about knowing how you read it, which pages you read, and how long you spent on each of them, and what you did next, and what you had been doing immediately before. In the world in which there is no anonymity of reading, there will be no assurance of the freedom of thought. In a world in which there is no anonymity of reading, there is no assurance of freedom of thought. Freedom of thought in such a world becomes a fragile artifact, subject everywhere, at all times, to immediate destruction. And most of the reading you do is not anonymous. The library is closed. You're not even on this campus. The physical book is mostly dead to you now. And the beauty of existence in a university where all the books are available and nobody watches you read them, that beauty has been destroyed, partly by the epidemic and partly by the nature of the university's determination to save its economic self by radically changing the product and charging you the full preceding price for it. But in that world, where the library is shut and almost everything is an electronic document and you are reading without tradecraft, almost everything you read is surveilling you while you read it, is knowing who you are and what you're doing with it, and keeping track of that and conducting analytics on it. This, more than the pervasive surveillance of physical activity on the street, is the true Orwellian meaning of where we live now. That you are seen when you go to the store, that there are 1,000 video cameras between you and the corner that you go to, even in the epidemic? Yeah, that's true and that's important. But it's nowhere near as important as the pervasive surveillance of everything you read. I don't need to explain that the anonymity of reading in Hong Kong is the difference between freedom and subjection. Everybody sees it now. I wouldn't have needed to explain the importance of the anonymity of reading to friends in the Soviet Union. It's odd, disappointing, but absolutely cruelly real that the anonymity of reading is an idea which needs explanation to almost everybody in the advanced societies now, and with which, as a matter of fact, the children of those societies have never previously encountered. They didn't even know that once upon a time it was there, because they are accustomed to the knowledge that reading is in some way or another surveilled, and they have no conception of what that really means. Here, in the world of anonymity, we confront a problem in heuristics, in human understanding and its learning, which is also to be found in the world of secrecy. It is a fundamental error in the way we think that we assume that our privacy, whether it is our secrecy or our anonymity, primarily concerns some big things we want to keep from other people. That we have particular secrets we are trying to keep, and that there are some particular activities which we want to make covert and which we want to dissociate from our identities. This is true. It's evidently true. We have secrets, and we do things we don't want attached to our known identities for particular reasons. It might be said, if we were going to pursue the social psychology of this subject, that unfortunately, a vast proportion of these secrets and these covert activities are secret and covert because of shame. For those of us who live in shame cultures, that's obvious. Everything is because of shame. And for those of us who don't live in shame cultures, that's a problem, because shame is the most single destructive emotion of which human beings are capable. But nonetheless, We have a tendency, because of the radioactivity of the emotion shame, to attach a lot of the things of which we are ashamed to our needs for secrecy and anonymity, and then the shame transfers to them. And this is part of why it is possible to make anonymity appear shameful overall. But this, as I say, is based entirely on a heuristic failure that human beings who do not in general think probabilistically, that is not the way that our brains evolved, and therefore our minds are bent, the nature of our privacy is not primarily contained in the one or two or 12 big secrets we don't want anyone to know. The nature of our privacy is instead contained in the immensity of details, which we do not even think about as we live our lives, and which, when linked together, become a model of ourselves that others can have better access to than we do. We live our lives touching things and leaving fingerprints behind. We don't think of those fingerprints as durable. We don't assume that everything we've ever touched is known to be a thing that we have touched in some great long list of everything we touched and every other person touched and all the touching that ever happened. We do not yet assume that everywhere we go, the skin cells that we leave behind us in that little pigpen-like cloud following us everywhere, the dandruff of our bodies, we do not think of that as containing DNA that can be used to identify every single place we stood and every... We don't think in terms of the persistence of the immensity of detail and the forms in which the linkage of that detail creates an alter ego of ourselves. We think in terms of the secrets, the ones which titillate us or which we regard as shameful or which we are afraid will be disclosed. And so we imagine the nature of our privacy incorrectly. With the anonymity aspect of our privacy, this is particularly true. And so again, we focus on the episode of anonymity, the thing I did, the thing I said, the place I was, where I specifically wanted my identity dissociated from my action or my message or my reading, the one thing about which my identity should be a secret. And because we think episodically about the nature of our need for anonymity, we miss the real need, which is the need to have a space in which we are not defined for power by everything we've done and thought and read, as well as everything we've said. The goal of anonymity is the form of privacy which is in the end, well, the one towards which a literary form attaches. When Louis Brandeis said in the article that he and his law partner made about privacy in the end of the 19th century, when he said that privacy was the right most valued by civilized men, the right to be let alone, he captures in the end the libertarian aspect, the being let alone aspect, which is, because Americans are people who particularly expect to be let alone, but then only men, which is the basis for the powerful structure of privacy in American constitutional law, meaning autonomy, the freedom to walk, loaf, and stroll, as William O. Douglas said in Doe against Bolton, the companion case to Roe against Wade, which is at the center of the idea of constitutional privacy in the United States, as about things like contraception and abortion, the decision to bear or beget a child, the being left alone, which establishes the autonomy aspect of privacy, depends in the end upon being alone in some functional sense. If you can't be alone, you can't be let alone. And aloneness turns out to be about the ability to divorce your identity, to detach it from the world around you. To be alone isn't necessarily to be secret, but it is to be anonymous. When I walk down the street in the city, when the street is crowded full of people, as it has been in my life and one day will be again, when I walk down the street, I'm not secret. It is true. I am there on the street. I have a face. If somebody who knows me sees me there, they can walk up to me and say, "Hi, Edmund, how are you?" But I am alone, because nobody around me knows or cares who I am. They are busy going about their lives, and nobody is keeping track. Which is what cities have been since the beginning of cities. In the village, it's true, everybody knows who you are. Cheers. But in the city, people don't. At least they didn't. At least without facial recognition cameras and a ton of computation, you were just you, alone. Therefore, a person who could be let alone because you are alone, because there is anonymity, there is autonomy. And when a person is alone with a book, she's alone. The book is not surveilling her. When a person is alone with her smart-ass phone, she is not alone. And it is that absence of aloneness, the absence of the anonymity of being the only human being or other sentient entity which knows who you are, when you are alone, that makes it possible to be something new and different, which is what the city has always offered to the people who moved there. Urbanization, like the state, is the consequence of writing. And urbanization, contrary to the state, creates a form of inherently small-scale power, the power to be alone. And people have moved to cities since there were cities, which means they have used writing to create a system of aloneness in the comprehensive density of human beings since there was Sumer or before. This is the crucial aspect of the third era of human life, the life in which teaching is conducted by writing, that there are cities, there is anonymity, there is aloneness, and therefore there is at least the possibility of individual creation of a life. Becoming something new, being someone new, changing in a fundamental way that villages repress and destroy. And when we pass into the next era of human life, this fourth era into which we are entering, and that no longer is what the urbanization of society means, when all the cameras on every corner and all the books in all the libraries are reporting in, that's gone. Hence our need to understand that this is not a peripheral, damaging louche or badass way of being, this is what it is that made the human beings of the last 9,000 years, and in particular made the human beings of the last 500. The ones who had a sense that the individual comes first, that her, as well as his, as well as their autonomies, freedoms, abilities to grow and learn and change and make themselves what they want to be, depend upon that most valuable of rights to be let alone, which depends in turn upon the ability to be alone, which depends in part upon interference with the structures currently being built around us, which, as an unintended consequence now becoming fully intended, are designed to make every act of thought and action attributable, and therefore to eliminate the ability to be alone and change in ways undesired by power, private or public. This then is where the issue of anonymity is most important. Not in the question of can we write a thing which talks smack against the emperor. Not in the question of whether we may defame or revenge ourselves against others, not in the question of whether we have ways of undermining the systems of taxation. Those are all valid points worthy of discussion, important to get to, but they are footnotes on the back of the back page. The goal of policy from the moment that Stuart Baker said, but nobody here cares about anonymity, do they, until now, the goal of policy has been primarily to confuse the subject. Which is why, when we talk about this, we are immediately confronted with our own mental reflexes to minimize. Oh, this is not important. This is anonymity. This is a thing for criminals and terrorists and drug dealers and tax evaders. No, that's wrong. But it's really important to understand that that idea grew from roots at the end of the 20th century, whose roots are to be found in the needs of public and private power, and that making invisible the importance of our anonymity is designed so that we will not see it even when it is shown to us, as I am now trying to do. At the technical level, as I said last time, anonymity is, unlike secrecy, in conflict with fundamental design principles of the evolution of the network. In order to move packets around efficiently, networks need to know where the packets are going. And in order to deal with the possibilities of error and loss, which are overwhelming at every given moment, in every place, at every time, regardless of whether the pipes are disrupted by the friction, the breaking copper wires, or from the effects of lightning and sunspots on electromagnetic communication, or the errant gamma ray passing through and swiping a bit in any particular unshielded chip. In order to deal with errors in transmission, we not only need to know where packets are going, but where they came from, so that it is possible to say, I didn't get that. Can you resend, please? So when we are thinking about the nature of the networks around us, we are immediately confronted with the fact that anonymity, unlike secrecy, can only be added in some process which fights against the immediate efficiency of the network. This is unimportant in the larger scale of the evolutionary biology. All sorts of systems in biological entities, like systems in political entities, work precisely because they decrease the efficiency of processes. Everybody now understands in the midst of the epidemic that the immune system of a human being is an immensely complicated structure of intended failure. If it works too well, it can kill a person. And so, in saying that anonymity is a technical property of communications that can only be achieved against the grain of the efficiency of the network hosting those communications, we're not dooming it. But we have a recognition to make that in the technology, we don't achieve anonymity by elegance of architecture. We achieve anonymity by kludging, by working against the forms of simplicity or elegance or efficiency of structure that are the glory of the system we are improving. One of the questions, therefore, is how do we achieve a dissociation of identity from message in a network which needs to know the endpoints of communication in order to function? We can use secrecy to conceal identity. If Bob and Carol wish to exchange messages that nobody else can know are from Bob to Carol or the otherwise, they can arrange by using secrecy to achieve that. If, for example, there is a Ted or an Alice willing to help them, if I want, as Bob, to send a message to Carol to which Carol can effectively reply without knowing that it comes from Bob, I can use Alice's anonymity system, if she has one. In other words, I send a message to Alice, encrypted to Alice, containing a message encrypted to Carol. And I say to Alice, here, send this to Carol for me, please. And Carol receives a message, which she can read because it's encrypted to her. And it says, hello, I am your mystery admirer. I asked Alice to send this to you. You can communicate with me through Alice. Here's a key. And Carol can then write a message back to the mystery admirer, encrypting it with the key she's been given, which doesn't contain any identity information. It just says, from a stranger to a stranger. And she can encrypt that, and then she can encrypt it to Alice and send it back to Alice's anonymity system and say, here, send this to wherever you got it from. And Alice can do that. And Bob and Carol have now had a perfectly effective anonymous conversation. The problem for each of them is that Alice knows. Alice is the point of weakness in this. She has an anonymity system, but she has to keep track of everybody. We can solve the problem by adding Ted. Ted also has an anonymity system, and he and Alice converse. And so Bob sends a message through Alice to Carol with a reply key included, encrypted to Carol so that nobody else can read it, but also encrypted to Alice so nobody can see it while it gets to Alice. But this time, instead of telling Alice, send this to Carol, the message says, send this to Ted. Ted then finds that he's got an encrypted message, which he decrypts, which says, send this to Carol, and that message can be sent to Carol. Ted knows that the message was sent to Carol, but he doesn't know where it came from because it came to him from Alice, who has an anonymity system. And Alice knows that she got something from Bob, but she doesn't know that it went to Carol. She only knows that it went to Ted. And so Ted and Alice would have to be both betraying their information, and they'd have to know how to link it up to one another, and they really don't. But just to make it easier, we could have 15 more people in the train, and nobody in the train knows anything about the ultimate endpoints, only that they got it from Ted or Alice or Billy or Bob or whoever it was, or Billy or Stephen or whoever it was. Bob and Carol are obscure at the endpoints of that process. They wish to communicate that way because they wish to preserve anonymity, but even if they didn't, there's no way that they could betray the other endpoint because they don't know. And the number of midpoints that would have to be working together to betray the endpoints is too large to be credible. This is essentially the process by which we can have anonymous or pseudonymous email to which people can actually respond. And we can think of this not just in terms of email transmissions, but actual browsing through the net. The use of those intervening midpoints who know only about the points to which they are connected and nothing about the ultimate points of entry or exit, this is what is known as onion routing. It is the structure of the program called Tor, which uses this principle of secrecy to support anonymity by multiple chaining of secret communications wrapped. All of which is done so automatically that your browser, if it is the Tor browser, simply sees the same web everybody else sees, but everything that goes back and forth between the websites and the search engines and all the other things you're doing, everything that goes back and forth runs through chains like this. It slows it down. It doesn't increase performance. That's the efficiency penalty we are paying for fighting against the architecture of the net. But the process gives us, whether we are sending and receiving email without exchanging identity information, or actually conducting activity in the web, which includes not just reading and writing in websites, but which includes also being on chat systems with controlled pseudonyms. That is, we're known on the chat system, we have a name, we're such and such on the chat system, but who is such and such? Well, we don't know because such and such created that nick on the chat system through a Tor gateway. So what is happening when we use secrecy to support anonymity is that we are gaining a cryptographic distance between real identity and apparent identity. And we are using that cryptographic structure to undermine the efficiency of the network by running signals around from pillar to post until it is, in practical terms, difficult. We can never say impossible, but difficult, even for the best teams with the best computation equipment and the broadest surveillance of the net, it is difficult to correlate between the endpoints of any transaction of communication. And for practical purposes, that means somebody somewhere is alone doing her own thinking. We'll see in the course of the exercises how to operate not just a browser through a network like that, but to build an operating system which only communicates with the network like that. In other words, the operating system takes care that it never engages in forms of communication which disclose an endpoint. It is always working through an onion routing structure, and therefore, for practical purposes from outside that computer, there's no radar. It's a stealthy thing. If the operating system so described also takes careful precautions to avoid leaving any marks behind on the computer where it was running, it just started up and did what it needed to do and existed and then went away, if it is truly only there for the briefest of time. So it discloses nothing about its identity, and it leaves no marks behind, And you can boot it up on a computer and do whatever it is that that computer needs to do for the purpose of being a stealthy object. And then it goes away and leaves no trace behind. That would be useful. And of course, free software did it, and of course we have it, and we call it the Amnesiac Incognito System, Tails, which we will learn to install and run on our personal computers in the third and fourth technical exercises. We can have something that approximates an anonymity in the net, though the net is itself architected not to provide for anonymity because it needs endpoint information in order to conduct its business. This is an immune response. It's a form of deliberately ineffective system for preventing the fundamental physiology of the net from working too well, harming the entities that lie within the scope of that nervous system, who are us. If this is what we mean then by anonymity, we can begin to understand more profoundly what we mean when we say that the last and most important property of privacy is autonomy, which is our ability to make our decisions in life free of the consequences of violations of secrecy and anonymity. It should be clear then from the beginning, as we think about autonomy, that the violations of secrecy and anonymity that are most important aren't necessarily the ones about what we say or even what we do. They might be the ones about what we read, what we think, what we hear, and who we hear it from. In other words, that the most powerful threats to autonomy are threats against the undergirding of anonymity that allows for freedom of thought. It may be my own particular bias, because freedom of thought is the cause for which I have lived and for which I am prepared to die. Naturally, I overestimate the importance of whatever it is I'm willing to die for, as we overestimate the importance of our children and our parents and our siblings, the ones we love and for whom we would sacrifice ourselves. But even if I am a little bit too jazzed about the freedom of thought, you yourself are at least part of the same team. You know you are. Even if you grew up in a society in which the concept of freedom of thought didn't exist, or had been so heavily propagandized against that people weren't really sure why it mattered, once you are living in a university in a more or less free society like our own, the freedom of thought is the air you breathe and the water you drink. And even if you can be unconscious of it, as we are unconscious of the air we breathe and the water we drink, it is sustaining you. The culture of the freedom of thought is what you share with everybody all around you, if, that is, you were physically in a university in which there were people all around you, which is why the epidemic is dangerous to the freedom of thought. Because we know that we have freedom of thought because we see that we are with thinkers. It's hard to contain the need for the freedom of thought when no one around us is doing free thinking, though it can be done. This is the source of Carlo Ginzburg's masterpiece of the vernacular history of common culture, The Cheese and the Worms, about a 16th century miller named Manocchio who lived in the part of the world between Yugoslavia and Italy in the Friuli, and who in the 16th century was just a common man who did read books and thought freely, and was therefore murdered by the Inquisition. But we have, even in our solitude, even when we are connected to the thinkers of the world only by the network that surveils us, we have an awareness, we cannot lose it, that our learning is our property, that our ideas are our own, that we are free in them, that, as the late medieval German song puts it, die Gedanken sind frei. So, if we misunderstand our anonymity and have been helped to lose the relevance of this idea to the fundamental conception of the freedom of thought, then we must have mistaken our autonomy as well, since it rests upon that pillar. And indeed, we do misunderstand our autonomy in a fashion that derives from our failure to grasp the importance of the anonymity of reading. You see in the writings of the colleagues around you, when you read their essays in the wiki, you see again a repeated understanding of what it is that the platforms do. The verbs are always the same. They can predict and they can control behavior because of their knowledge gained by the violations of secrecy and anonymity. That the form in which autonomy violation occurs is prediction and control. These are dark propositions, that we can be predicted and controlled by the knowledge of what we have been reading and clicking on and thinking about and where we are and how fast we're walking. And at least asymptotically, that can be true. Ultimately, the technology trends in the direction of being capable of prediction and control. But here we are studying this term, largely the area of what the law professors like to call private law and private society. And whatever may be the ultimate possibilities of prediction and control, that's not the immediate goal. The immediate goal is influence. To say that our autonomy is violated because we are predicted by models contained in the databases of the platforms, that Facebook knows what we're going to do next, that Amazon knows what we're going to do next, that we are predictable to them like billiard balls in a physics problem, is ambitious, let us say, in view of what they actually have. And to say that we are controlled is evidently incorrect, which is why so much of the essay writing ultimately concludes that while there may be an effort at control by Facebook or Amazon or Expedia, it cannot work. That's true. The problem presents itself in an overhyped form and therefore is easier in the end not to worry too much about. But really, of course, once one corrects for that overhyping, one is left with the real story of the data mining platforms and everybody who coexists with the parasite, with the mind of God. The goal isn't to control, it's to influence. The house edge in the casino doesn't come from the fact that the casino wins 100% of the time, that the player always loses, that the house is in control. The house edge may be tiny. At the end of the day, in a blackjack game, there may be no house edge, which is why the house has to throw out the best players. Not the cheaters, the best players, the ones who can count the cards. But the house is very, very powerful, at least if it isn't run by Donald Trump. The house is very profitable indeed, even if its edge is only 2 or 3%. In the end, the mathematics are remorseless. The same is true of the principle of influence in the question of our autonomy. If we are 5 or 6 or 8% more likely to do a thing because of some violations of secrecy and anonymity which have allowed some third party to get that much of an edge in influence, the mathematics are remorseless. Influence is what social psychology studies, the influence of minds on minds, not the control of minds by minds. Not the power of direction, but the power of suggestion does the work, and the mathematics are remorseless. It doesn't matter whether you think in terms of the class conditioning the teacher by laughing and smiling and clapping in direct proportion to the nearness of the teacher to the door, such that in the famous experiment, the teacher winds up standing out in the hallway teaching because he has been progressively reinforced into moving further and further away from the lectern by the reinforcement behavior of the class. Or whether it is the possibility that 70% of the voters in the Republican Party can be convinced that an election which resulted in the very same result for Joseph Biden that Donald Trump called a landslide when he gained it, save that Joe Biden has also got 5 million more votes than Donald Trump, where last time around Donald Trump, the winner of the landslide, had 3 million votes less than his opponent, that 70% of Republicans can be led to believe that there is something unfair, rigged about this election. That's not control. That's not prediction. That's the influence of minds on minds, the creation of a climate of opinion which generates the likelihood or even just the possibility of an opinion in other minds. That's all we mean when we talk about a violation of autonomy if it results from the infringement of the secrecy or the anonymity of the mind being influenced. Now, it is, of course, possible to say that there is a violation involved in the fact that Amazon knows everything about what I have shopped for on Amazon since forever. A violation of anonymity, however, it is difficult to claim because I identified myself to Amazon. I asked them to ship me goods. They keep track of everything I've ever done because I began by introducing myself to them. And so to say of the influence that they have gained that it's an autonomy violation because it was gained through a compromise of anonymity wouldn't be right. If I don't know, however, that Amazon is also buying all my other clicktrail, that like Google and Facebook, it really wants to know everything about what I've done in the last 45 minutes before I showed up at the store. In other words, if it is linking its own knowledge of what I do to other knowledge of what I do, of which I am unconscious, then it becomes possible to begin to say that its interference with my autonomy arose from its capturing of information I didn't know it had. There isn't any doubt that intelligence services exist in order to reduce the autonomy of other countries' behaviors. The whole purpose of intelligence services lies beyond the mere information of decision makers. That is the primary task envisioned in the incarnated in the production of the president's daily brief that Donald Trump now doesn't want Joe Biden to be getting. The information compiled for the use of the decision makers in the home countries of the intelligence services. But that's only part of what they do. The other part of what they do is to use what they know to influence decision makers elsewhere by trading information, by disclosing inconvenient facts, by control of the timing of discourse and the forces of facts on the ground influencing other decision makers' policies, by direct engagement, active listening, and corruption of the data streams of opponents. All of those activities are ultimately designed at increasing the influence of the state for which the intelligence service works. And this is equally true in the context of private profit making. The current competition law activities designed to address in the European Union in particular the question, is Amazon using the information that it has about the buying practices of people who buy from third-party sellers using the platform to compete unfairly against those sellers on the platform by developing competing products and offering them to the same customers at lower prices with an Amazon suggests kind of a banner? All of that inquiry into the competition effect is really about the autonomy violation on the part of Amazon with respect not to the buyers but to the sellers, based on Amazon's superior ability to influence buyer behavior. In this sense, then, we find that both the anonymity component of privacy and the autonomy component of privacy are not about disclosure of secrets so much as they are about the creation of linking. As I said last time, it is a primary element of what has happened in the construction of the species-wide nervous system that it links ideas, that the technologies of the net and the technologies of the individual computers attached to the net are technologies of linking. When we wish to prevail over our opponents with respect to the preservation of our own autonomy, what we are mostly attempting to do is to prevent them from linking information in ways that create influence over us of which we are unaware and which arise from other underlying violations of our secrecy or anonymity of our privacy. If we are then to think about methods, whether they are regulatory methods or individual technological methods or political methods, if we are then to think about how to create methods to protect autonomy, we will find ourselves increasingly addressing elements of linking or delinking. This is really what that so-called right to be forgotten was meant to turn into, and which the bureaucrats of the European Commission slowly backing away from the delusional thinking of Vivian Reding came up with. It wasn't a right to be forgotten, it was a right to be de-indexed. A poignard pointed at the heart of the search engines from the point of view of the search engines. But really a kind of grossly misformed effort to address the problem of the link. Misformed because it addresses not the problem of the link by the party seeking to create influence, but rather the link in the mind of the individual seeking information who conducted a search and found out that a Spanish dentist went bankrupt once. A problem because we want to interfere with linking that does harm in the destruction of anonymity because we want to protect the freedom of thought, and next thing we know, we're attacking the freedom of thought. The problem of immune systems is that they are powerful and failure-prone by design and therefore can and will attack the wrong thing. But we are primarily concerned then with the question, what should be connected to what? In order to have freedom of thought, all ideas should be able to connect to all the other ideas that human beings have raised in them. Unless we know where thought leads us, we don't know where thought, what thought is. But if we are to manage the influence of minds on minds, when the minds doing the influencing are the parasite with the mind of God and its computers and its human handworkers, if we are to understand how to make the space to be alone, not linked into the network of ideas about people that the parasite with the mind of God can have, then from a legal and philosophic point of view, we are engaged in trying to understand which connections to reinforce and which to inhibit in the construction of this nervous system. A problem of physiology that is also deeply a problem of philosophy and law. And in the next period of this course, as even the conception of hybrid instruction is allowed to die before it can be resurrected in an even more deadly form in the spring, when we are really alone with our network, our drafts, our version file systems, and our thoughts, in the next few weeks of the course, it becomes my pleasure and responsibility to explain how we fix all that we have broken. Which would be simpler if we didn't have to worry about the human desire to create and enforce taboos. And it is in this process of going from the understanding of influence to the understanding of inhibition that we add our last physiological property to this understanding, and then we can begin to fix our net. Talk to you soon.